My castaway this week is a performer. That's his description of a career that's included pop music, art and acting among its achievements. An Essex boy, he contracted polio when he was 7 and has been severely disabled ever since. After a somewhat erratic education, he went to art school, but graduated in his 30s to writing and performing songs. With his group, the Blockheads, he enjoyed huge success, particularly with numbers like Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick. Although his popularity as a singer has since waned, he remains in the public eye, still writing songs with vivid lyrics, acting, and taking a controversial attitude towards disability. He dismisses such events as International Year for the Disabled, for instance, because he says they imply that next year everything will be all right when it won't. He is Ian Dury. It's true you're not one of the disabled lobby's favourite people, isn't it, Ian?
I believe it is, yeah.
Do you go out of your way to upset them?
No. Things that are run by people who know what they're running it for. In other words, if everything like that was run by people who are disabled, I think I'd probably have a different attitude. But at the end of 1981, I got sent a huge brochure asking me to be the front man for 1982, the year of recycled glass. So it really says it all.
But I suppose that was the high point of your alienation, as you say, 1981. I think you wrote Spasticus Autisticus, a song that you argued, I think, celebrated disability, but a lot of people found it objectionable, didn't they? And it was pretty harsh, you know, get up, get down, fall down.
It celebrated life. It didn't celebrate disability. It celebrated the fact that one or we or they were still alive afterwards. It was more of a... not a war cry, but a kind of a rallying cry.
Well, why didn't they like it then?
We don't use the word spastic anymore because it became a kind of swear word or a racist word. But
you knew that when you put it in the title, didn't you?
Yeah, I felt upset hearing or reading people using that word without really even knowing what it meant and using it as a way of describing a dance or something. And I did it as a war cry, really, as a shout. It wasn't as my mum got very upset about me doing it at all. And I just said, well, don't forget, suddenly the entertainment industry. I said, Monday morning lavatory paper is much more important.
Well, yes, except that you had great influence then because you just had this series of big hits. You were a pop star, although an unlikely one, it has to be said. One of your critics described you as looking like a pantomime villain with loose sideburns and greasy curls and body canted over on a walking stick.
Golly,
and what's more, you were 36 at the time.
And what's loosh? What does loosh mean? I don't know that one. I'm not a loosh end.
But how surprised were you that you became a pop star?
I wasn't that surprised because I think really it's all down to what you write on your table at home. If you've written a good song, it will jump off the table, go out in the street, get a taxi and go down Tin Pan Alley and make a living for you.
So what you look like doesn't matter?
I'm not going to mention any names. You've seen Engelbert Humperdinck? No, I don't think so. I don't think it matters a single bit, no.
And did it matter to you? I just wonder, actually, when you walk out onto a stage, when you are disabled, as you were, when you do have the stick and so on, did it make you more aware of yourself?
No, not at all. I was once accused in a place called the Nashville, which was a music pub. Somebody came up to me afterwards and said, you're putting that on. I said, no, I'm not, I'm hiding it. And about 2 years later, I met a doctor and he said, I love the way you disguise it. So either way, I just walk the middle line. I don't really think about it at all. Although I'm severely disabled in some ways, I'm not restricted that much by it. I can't run for buses, but I don't really mind missing a few buses.
Tell me about your first record.
Well, my first band was called Kilburn on the High Roads, and our manager was Charlie Gillett, who's a renowned and very erudite disc jockey. And he played this song, and the bass is playing the pedals on a Hammond organ. I'd never heard of the guy before, Bobby Charles, and I just loved this song.
It's all small town talk. You know how people are. They can't stand the sea. Someone else doing what they like. It's all small town talk. You mustn't pay no mind. Don't believe a word.
Small Town Talk, written and performed by Bobby Charles. There's another reason that you are an unlikely pop star, Ian Dury, and that is that singing is not your forte, is it?
No.
You have a habit of changing key when nobody else does.
Oh, no, come along now. Be fair. I try and avoid things like that. I try and plow a straight course through the middle of all these things called key changes and chords.
But that's why you develop this, I think they call it your Essex growl, really, just sort of standing there chanting, as it were.
I think I've got quite a reasonable sense of rhythm, so I kind of try not to interfere too much with the music when I'm doing it.
But that's what it is all about. I mean, hit me with your rhythm stick was not just a phrase you plucked out. Rhythm is what it's all about, isn't it? It's that beat, beat, beat.
It's the groove, really. It's what we call the groove. And if you've got a good groove, it's a rhythm pattern and a certain tempo, and the words find their own tempo, and it's usually the right one. If it means a certain thing, you'll say it or you'll sing it in the same tempo every time. So counting in a tune, I always think, where's the middle eight, or where's the bit that goes that, 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 and that will give you the clue as to the tempo. And those things are quite important. If you play something too fast, it ends up a scrambled egg. Or if you play it too slow, everyone falls asleep.
So when you're writing the words, you do invent the rhythm at the same time, do you? I mean, that's...
I work with a rhythm. I write, I program a rhythm. And where my sibilances come in, if S's and T's, you can get, the hi-hat, the one that one.
Yes.
And then you design that so that it kind of goes with what you're doing, or goes against it, or goes as a polyrhythm to that in terms of the words. Once I'm happy with that I can actually forget about it after that. And I mean, I wouldn't ask a drummer to copy anything. I mean, it's just to make sure that I've got the space for the lyric and then work with the composer.
Now, what about those lyrics, the language? Because they say you were Essex man 15 years before he was invented, I think. You like all of that, don't you? The Cockney kind of rhyming slang, or that kind of Cockney accent. Cultivated all of that.
I've cultivated. I grew up in Upminster, and I grew up with a local accent, and I've savoured it. And I remember the first time I heard rhyming slang, I remember a bloke in Upminster went, "Oh, look at the state of his barnet." And I went, "What's that?" He goes, "Barnet is your hair, your barnet fair." I found it very amusing. And ever since then, I was about 14 or 13, I've hung around with people and I've talked with people who enjoy it as well. I worked with Roger Lloyd Pack a few years ago on a project, and he came in and said, "Oh, I'm having terrible trouble with my April." And I went, "April, you got me there, Roger, what is it, go on?" Well, there's this long, long thing of your Harris is your bottom, right? Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And now that it goes Harris, Aristotle, bottle, and glass arse. And I'll go, "Well, tell me, it's April in Paris. Harris." I mean, OK.
Give me a few lines that you've written that you're proudest of, then. What would you choose? Oh. Difficult question.
Oh. I like Harold Hill of Harold Hill. I got into a taxi a couple of years ago, and the bloke went, "You're from Upminster, ain't you?" I went, "Yeah." He goes, "Do you know my favourite?" I go, "Go on, tell me." He goes, "Harold Hill of Harold Hill." Because if you've been to Harold Hill, it's a place in between Brentwood and Romford. Harold Hill. So, home improvement expert Harold Hill of Harold Hill, of do-it-yourself dexterity and double glazing skill, came home to find another gentleman's kippers in the grill, so he sanded off his winkle with his Black and Decker drill. I think that's quite funny. I'll still laugh at that one.
Am I right in thinking it was you who coined the phrase sex, drugs and rock and roll?
I've been credited with it. It seemed a logical thing to do at the time.
You're in the dictionary of quotation.
I believe so, yeah. I'm quite proud of that. I kept getting on escalators and seeing a lingerie advert, and then somebody from the feminist movement had come along and stuck a sticker over that saying, "This is sexist," which, again, it doubled up the amount of time wasted on this subject. And I thought, well, people going back home, if that's all they got in their mind after they've been doing their day's work, there must be something better. And I really wrote Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll. Well, great, they're there. And then what else have we got? Let's go to the National Gallery, or implying there are
more
things fun things
life to
do. And, of course, everyone started singing it as soon as we did. The audience joined in and it became a kind of anthem.
And it got banned by the BBC.
Definitely.
Tell me about your second record.
Dean Martin was one of my dad's favourites, and my mum loved Dean Martin very much. And I can remember my dad singing this all over the place.
When you are in a dream, but you know
You're not dreaming, signore. Scusa me, but you see, back in old Napoli, that's amore. Amore.
Dean Martin, and that's amore. So you were brought up in Essex, Ian Jury.
Yeah.
Your dad was a bus driver and your mother was a health visitor.
Yeah.
And by the time you were five, you'd been seen by three psychologists. What was the problem?
I think I refused to go to school. I don't actually remember seeing the psychologists, but my mum was a fairly... she was a totally brilliant mother. She steamed into me from a very early age and taught me to read before I went to school. So I think by the time I went to school, I didn't want to go there. I didn't see the point.
You were bored, were you?
I don't remember, but it must have been something like
were
that.
Were you rebellious, do you know?
I think I probably was, yeah.
So when and how did you contract polio? What happened?
Again, this is conjecture, but I went with my friend Barry. We went to Southend and went swimming, or got in the pool. And I was at my granny's about 8 weeks later, 6 weeks later, and I got ill. And they thought at first it might be meningitis, I think, and they gave me a lumbar punch. They took me to the hospital, and it turned out to be polio. And I think my friend Barry got a kind of fever for a couple of weeks, but wasn't affected. It didn't really go any further than that. But I was, you know, very ill for about 6 weeks.
But how did it affect you? What happened?
Well, it steamed into my muscles, and it stopped here at my right wrist. It got everywhere else except that. It didn't get my chest. I think I probably wouldn't have had the energy that I've got now if it had affected my... And very often polio affects your breathing, and that obviously in its own way affects your energy.
What it meant when you were 7, 8, was that you had to go to a special school for handicapped children. How did they help you?
They probably gave me a physical attitude of extreme determination. There was an unwritten rule that if you fell over, nobody was allowed to help you up, which was there to encourage you to be independent, not to be cruel.
Because otherwise you'd go under.
Well, you could possibly, yeah. And it was a training. It was called Chailey Heritage Craft School, which meant you learned to be a cobbler or a printer or a carpenter. And my mum, it was a fantastic place for physical welfare and getting strong again, which they certainly made me very strong again. But education, it was a little bit behind the times.
And not what your mother wanted.
Not
we'll
really.
Hear about that in a minute, but tell me about record number three there.
Well, this is for Mum. Frank Crummett. I got given a wind-up gramophone when I was about 14. And the first record of it was obviously my mum's favourite one, because it was Frank Crummett singing Abdullah Bulbul Amir, and I can remember all the words to this day.
Sons of the prophets were brave men and bold, and quite unaccustomed to fear. But the bravest by far in the ranks of the Shah was Abdullah Bulbul Amir. Now the heroes were plenty and well known to fame in the troops that were led by the Tsar. And the bravest of these was a man by the name of Ivan Skavinsky Skavar.
Frank Crummett and Abdul Abulbul Amir, and that was recorded in 1927. So your mother, Ian, transferred you to the Royal Grammar School, High Wycombe, when you were about 12, I think.
Yeah.
Because she didn't want you to be a cobbler or a carpenter.
Well, because she did want me to be a lawyer, rather than a negative. Yeah, she got me to take my 11 plus at the age of 12. Which I passed, and Essex County Council very kindly gave me a grant to go to High Wycombe.
Were you bullied because of your disability?
No, I wasn't bullied, no. I was. I think I was treated too kindly for about 6 months until they realised I could do most things myself, and I let them do it. I shouldn't have done, but I did. I let them make my bed until they realised I could make it myself.
But you did end up in tears on one occasion, didn't you?
They thought that the slipper didn't hurt me. They thought polio meant that you didn't feel pain. I had 16 prefects' meetings in half a term. And then they went to the headmaster and said, look, he doesn't feel pain. Can we mess his head up instead? Well, I didn't say that to him. But can we give him poetry to learn and essays to write instead, please, as a punishment for his misdemeanours? So the headmaster gave him permission. And I had to go in the box room where all the suitcases were stored. I learned 80 lines of Ode to Autumn by... Your man Keats. If I got a word wrong, I had to go back. They had that on to the end of the sentence. And after five nights of this, I was really... My head had definitely gone. And I burst into tears. Walking down the corridor, burst into tears. And a very nice man, I can't remember his name, he was a housemaster of another boarding house. He came out, saw me blubbing in the corridor. And because he was a father, he had some kids at the house and everything. And he came out with a natural fatherly. He put his arm around me. He said, "What's the matter?" I went, "Hey, they've got me, they've got me." And he, I presume it was him, he went and put a stop to it. I probably deserved it.
In the end, you were expelled.
I was expelled, yeah, rather.
Why?
I deny it. That's all I can say.
You still feel guilty about it, obviously. Gone quite pink. What were you alleged to have done, Mr. Drury?
I was alleged to have thrown a piece of fish at the headmaster's wife. But I didn't.
But you didn't.
I swear it.
I never.
I never.
But you were out.
I was gonzoed, yeah.
No O-levels, no A-levels.
I did take O-level, yeah. I did three. I got English, and art. And by which time I'd already had an interview at Walthamstow School of Art. I knew I was going there, so I didn't really mind.
Next piece of music, number four.
When I was 14 or 15, I went to see a film called The Girl Can't Help It, a Jay Mansfield vehicle, and it was just full of rock and rollers. It was Little Richard was in there, Eddie Cochran, and Jim Vincent singing Bebop a Lula. And it's in the film for about 18 seconds. And you can hear him in the background. I couldn't believe it. I was like, what's that? The voice, the song, and the visuals together combined, my brain exploded, my heart exploded. And this is the B-side to Bebop a Lula, his first major, massive single. And Woman Love is, I believe, is quite rude, but nobody knows what he's talking about. Nobody. I've asked people to... explain it, and nobody knows what he's saying.
Well, I'm looking for a loving gal that needs a lot of care. Don't mind about a finger, but the girl on her hand. The doctor really scared me when he said, "Good Lord above, a son, show around and needing you some woman love." Well, I'm tired of
Gene Vincent and Woman Love. Well, he knew what he was singing.
He knew it. It was banned everywhere, that one.
Right, art. Art, painting became your passion. In fact, you made a living at it, didn't you?
I made a living more as an illustrator and a teacher. I taught in art school.
Illustrating what kind of thing? What did you do?
Peter Blake was my... He did the famous Sergeant Pepper cover. He walked into Walthamstow Art School in 1961 and had a big effect on a lot of us, on my generation, showing us that it was possible to actually be inspired by what we were drawing rather than going out and drawing some old boring old pub in Leytonstone. He said, "Well, do you like pin-ups?" I went, "Yeah, naturally." And he went, "Well, why do you paint them?" Well, it seemed like a very good idea. And we went on, six of us got into the Royal College of Art from Walthamstow. And Peter Blake continued to teach us by starting to teach at the Royal College when we went there. And he got me some illustration work in my third year for London Life magazine. That was a short-lived... Mark Boxer used to be the editor. David Putnam was the financial director. David Hillman, Francis Wyndham. Wonderful people that all worked around the Sunday Times magazine. So I started working for the Sunday Times magazine as well.
But at some point, you started to play in pubs. This was Kilburn and the High Road.
Yeah, that was a long time ago. I got a group together of jazz musicians that I knew. It was the day of the Lord Mayor's show because a piano player got stuck in the traffic on the Lord, and it took ages to get the Jubilee Studios in Covent Garden because of the traffic jam. And by which time the saxophone player had fallen asleep. That was the first rehearsal.
But at what point then after that did you set up this very fruitful songwriting partnership with Chas Jankel?
Well, I met Chas in the Nashville. He came in the dressing room and he'd heard that we were looking for a keyboard player. We went out for a kind of last-ditch rehearsals with the Kilburns to see if it was going to work or not. And one morning I got up very, very sad. I knew it wasn't really happening. And I just played out, I got and sat in their drummer's drum kit and started hitting the drums as hard as I could, as trying to sound like Stevie Wonder playing the drums, which is just like that. And behind me I heard a piano. And I looked around, it was Chas. I stopped the band that weekend. And Chas and me started working together. And he's, he plays, whenever he plays his guitar or piano, he smiles. Even if he's working something out and worrying it out, he still smiles. And your heart lights up when you see him. And it's been like that for, you know, it sounds sobby, but for 19 years, he's never stopped smiling.
And together you wrote all those hits, Rhythm Stick, Reasons to Be Cheerful, Wake Up and Make Love With Me.
Yeah.
Another record banned by the BBC. Tell me about record number five.
When we were writing together at that period, in 1976 and 77, I'd always stayed away from blues musicians. I like jazz very much, and I like funky music and James Brown and soul music and cowboy music and reggae and dun-dun. I never really listened to 12-bar blues very much, Muddy Waters and Robert Johnson. I liked it up to a point, but it never really enthralled me. And one day I heard this record by Taj Mahal, and we listened to nothing but Taj Mahal for a whole year. We were writing together, New Boots and Panties. And this particular song, well, it says it for me anyway, music keeps me together.
Just taking the privilege to live myself, just making it what it is with what is left. Still trying to feel the abundant with the self, and I need to be sure that joy will stay around. Cause I need to be sure that joy will stay around.
Taj Mahal and Music Keeps Me Together. Can we talk a bit more about your style, Ian Dury? Because I think it's very distinctive. It's quite vaudeville, it's been said. You want to make people laugh. It's quite musical, isn't it?
I like it when it's funny. I like my lyrics best when they make me laugh, and especially if I make other people laugh.
You toured once with Max Wall, the comedian, didn't you?
Didn't tour with him. We asked him to introduce us.
Didn't he record one of your songs?
He did
Maxwell?
Do one. He did a song of ours, yeah.
England's Glory.
England's Glory, yeah. And we did ask him, and he came to Hammersmith Odeon and introduced us, and they just shouted at him and screamed at him, yelled at him. And I went out on stage and put my arm around him and harangued the audience for not giving him the respect. And I said, "Come on, Max, they don't deserve you." And as I'm walking across the stage to the wings, he went, "They only want the walks."
But what about those days, the height of your fame? Did you enjoy being famous? Did you enjoy having all those fans? What did it mean to you?
At the time, I really hated it, I'll be honest with you. I hated it. But I felt it was necessary to establish that kind of, whatever you call it, a bridgehead of some
sort.
What
did you hate about it?
I hate the fact I didn't have a moment to myself. I hate the fact every minute was spent doing interviews, blagging myself or blagging this and blagging that. That if I stood at Oxford Street in a rush hour, I'd get mobbed. I never wanted that. I read somewhere, Paul McCartney said, if he goes to, say, walking through Soho and he gets recognised, he walks briskly away. If I did, I'd trip over, so it's even worse. So I suddenly kind of became a prisoner of the fact that I had a bad leg, and just because I couldn't walk briskly away. And if you walk differently from everyone else, children are walking along the street with their mum, they'll notice you. People know, they can't help, it's not anything horrible, but they can't help noticing. And I get recognised as a result of the way I walk, rather than because I'm very recognisable. And being recognised by everybody all the time made me quite unhappy.
More music.
Well, this is my beloved Alma Cogan. In the Kilburns, we used to sing 20 Tiny Fingers. She put on the light in the middle of the night and whispered, "Dear, let's go." I grabbed the sock and called the doc. Various others, and one of the ones we sang was The Naughty Lady of Shady Lane, which has got a kind of edge to it.
The naughty lady of Shady Lane has hit the town like a bomb. The back fence gossip ain't been this good since Mabel ran off with Tom. Our town was peaceful and quiet before she came on the scene. The lady has started a riot, disturbing the suburban routine. Oh, the naughty lady of Shady Lane.
Alma Cogan singing The Naughty Lady of Shady Lane. One of the most notable things you've done since all that pop stardom, Ian, is write for the theatre, for example. Bawdy songs for an RSC production of that restoration comedy, The Country Wife, William Wycherley. It turned out to be right up your street, that, didn't it?
I loved it. I was in a play at the Royal Court called Road, a Jim Cartwright play. Max Stafford Clark, who when we work at the Royal Shakespeare, we call him Max Stratford Clark, which we think is very amusing, but I don't think he does. And he asked me to write, he said, "I'd like a showstopper." So the first one we did was called A Jovial Crew, which was about vagabonds in 1640 and with gypsy dancing. And I got the dictionaries of the Kenting tongue. People in Fulham still call their girlfriend their mort, M-O-R-T. And this is the Kenting tongue from probably gypsies 500, 600 years ago. And I, with Max's help, also the fact the author was no longer with us, he didn't complain about what I was doing. We had a wonderful time doing that.
You also wrote a musical, a whole musical of your own called Apples, which played at the Royal Court, about modern-day sex and scandal and the tabloids and politicians and so on, in which you played the lead, didn't you?
It was a kind of co-lead, really. I didn't play the ingenue. I played the older, the reporter, the cynic.
The hack.
It was the hack.
How big a difference is there between being on stage, you know, playing your music and being part of a whole musical production like that?
Well, in fact, not a lot, because we had a rock and roll band on the second tier at the back of the stage who were all mates of ours, and we could have a little wink and a nod. I made a mistake doing that. I was encouraged by, you know, very nicely by Max and Simon Curtis, the director. What I should have done, with hindsight, is to work with a playwright, because I'm not a playwright. And I had 15 songs, and I tried to write a story from one song to the next, which was not the right way to do it. If I ever do it again, I should work, hopefully, in collaboration with somebody, and I write the songs, and they can do the play.
Record number 7.
Anne Peebles, perfect song, perfect voice, perfect arrangement, and it's pretty perfect.
I can't stand the rain against my window, bringing back sweet memories. Yeah, window pane, do you remember how sweet it used to be?
Anne Peebles and I Can't Stand the Rain. There's little doubt that you're a survivor in the general sense, Ian. What about in the specific sense on a desert island? Have you got the talent for that?
Yeah, I'd love it.
Have you got family, children?
Yeah, I've got 2 grown-up children. Baxter's 24, Jemima's 27, and I've got a little baby boy now with Sophie. Baxter and Jemima's mum died 2 years ago. And I've got a little boy called Bill, who's 22 months old. And I've also got another one on the way.
I see. So you want to escape from this island to get back to all of them. What about to get back to performing with a capital P? I mean, do you need it? Do you want it?
I'm not a so-called junkie for it. I love doing it. Usually it's a happy occasion. The only reason we're all there is to enjoy ourselves. We're not there to be grumpy, and we're not there to be too profound. I've been accused of philosophy, I've been accused of poetry, but I'm not guilty of either. My attitude is to go out, slam those boards as hard as possible, and try and sing in tune.
And is that what you want to do some more of now? Do you want to get back on the stage there?
Yeah, every
age 54, you can still get away with it.
Oh, yeah, in fact, it's easier. One uses less manic energy and more expertise. I used to do songs and really give it 190 in the old mentals. I'd get a bit crackers. I don't do that anymore. I don't identify quite as strongly with my subject matter as I used to.
But you're writing songs currently.
Oh,
with,
yeah.
With Chaz.
Yeah, yeah.
With Chaz Jankel.
And the Blocks.
Are you pleased with them? Are we going to get to hear them?
We just recorded a group of songs as a group for the first time in 17 years with Chaz there as well. And they sound good. They sound fresh.
Last record.
Last record is one of my heroes from my youth. I've always loved jazz very much, and in the late 50s, early 60s, jazz had developed out of Charlie Parker and John Coltrane and Miles Davis, and it was, we used to call it, they called it the Cosa Nova, the new thing. And Ornette Coleman got together with the late and recently departed Don Cherry and a drummer called Billy Higgins and a fantastic bass player called Charlie Hayden. And they made a record called Change of the Century, which we had in our flat in the 60s. We used to know this off by heart. And the bass solo, which we're going to hear, is where Chaz and myself stole the idea for Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll. Dun, 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 dun. And I met Charlie Hayden some years after we'd recorded it. I said, Charlie, I nicked your solo. He says, OK, it's a Cajun folk tune. I stole it as well. And it goes around and around.
Ornette Coleman and Ramblin'. If you could only take one of those eight records, Ian, which one?
That one.
That one. You really like that,
yeah.
Don't you?
Yeah.
What about your book? You've got the Bible and you've got Shakespeare already there.
And I'd like, if possible, please, to have the Macmillan Dictionary of Art in all its 34 volumes at a cost of £5,700, please. That would keep me going. Thank
and what
you.
About your luxury?
Well, my luxuries would be a working item, which I have in my... I've got a room slightly bigger than this table at the moment where I work. And in there, I've got an 8-track studio with a 2-track studio underneath it, a mixing desk, a microphone, speakers, da-da-da-da-da. And it's all digital. I'd need a solar panel on the top to make it work, presumably. And that would keep me happy forever.
Ian Dury, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.